Good morning, Melissa Holyoke from the Nonprofit Center for Class Action Fairness. Your Honors, 23A4 requires that class representatives fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. They have to have the same interests and injuries. And A4 cannot be satisfied when there is a fundamental conflict between subgroups of a class. In this settlement, you have one group represented by the class representatives who receive compensation for their present claims, unauthorized charges, or similar losses. But then there's another group that my client belongs to who could suffer those same things in a year from now, and they get nothing under the settlement. Indeed, he's releasing all of his future claims. And there's another group, a statutory-only class claim. For example, there's millions of class members in California. If some of them didn't have actual damages, they're releasing all of their statutory damages claims, including the statutory damages that could be from $500 to $3,000 in California, and those are all being released for no compensation. There's no question here that there was a conflict, and it's best summed up by class counsel's own words at the fairness hearing. They said they weren't going to, quote, hold up recovery for clients who suffered actual damages, close quote, for members like my client who didn't have actual damages. That's at page 402 of the record. The problem is that the future damages claims group and the statutory-only claims groups, they didn't have anyone representing them at the negotiating table. They didn't have anyone there representing these folks. In Ortiz, the Supreme Court said, quote, it is obvious after Amchem that a class divided between holders of present and future claims requires division into homogeneous subclasses under 23C4B with separate representation to eliminate conflicting interests of counsel.
Well, this depends on the facts of the case, of course. And what do you haven't mentioned the district judge yet. The district judge made a finding on adequacy at the beginning of the case. An objection was raised, and the district judge says that he was not revisiting that.
Correct, Your
Honor. Why isn't that enough?
That is not enough, Your Honor. Under this court's opinion in Petrovich, this court said the district court has an ongoing duty to make sure that once a case is certified, it remains certifiable. And here he abandoned that duty when he said he would not revisit that determination. But here's the problem because of why Amchem was so concerned here about having a heightened attention to these problems. Target and plaintiff, they come into the district court, and they come in with a settlement, and they are on a united front. They want this to go through. This is a great deal. We want everyone want this settlement to go through, and Rule 23 is satisfied. But there's no adversarial context there. There had been no motion to certify the class, so no one had challenged adequacy there. This is the problem that Amchem talked about. And why 23A4, why the courts need to have a heightened, undiluted attention to A4 and the adequacy problems. But the court can go further and find that A4 conflict that A4 is not satisfied here, Your Honor, based on the facts of this case.
You're saying this court, the Court of Appeals, should do that?
Yes.
Why shouldn't that be for the district court, even if you were right about everything else you say?
Because as a matter of law, there is a conflict here. This case
is
no different.
I thought of 112 class representatives. We know nothing about 106 of them. We have no evidence about 106 of the 112 class representatives. Is my premise right, that we know nothing about them?
Maybe I'm not understanding your question in terms of not knowing anything about them.
We don't know anything about them. Are they identical to Olson, different from Olson?
Well, all of them are different in terms of they all suffered actual damages. The complaint says that. Every paragraph they list some damages. They also have future damages, you're right. They are like Olson in that sense. But just because they might have those interests overlap.
But does the record show anything about 106 of the 112 class representatives, other than the assertions by the other side that they're similar?
No, you're correct. You're correct, Honor, that other than the assertions
and
the complaints.
Well, isn't that a matter for the district court and not this court?
Well, it should, but he didn't consider that evidence, and he just rubber-stamped
But supposing he's wrong, shouldn't the district court determine that first? As you said, the district court has the ongoing duty, Petrovic, to review class actions. That seems like we ought to get the district court working.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, that we should. But here, we can look at what the, even as asserted, the plaintiff's claims as asserted, and their claims as asserted, there's a conflict between those and my client and other groups of people that are not being represented here. Because the claims as asserted that they have actual claims, present damages claims. They might have future too, but the overlap is not enough. You need representatives that are represented separately by counsel who can represent just the future damages claims individuals, those without present damages. And the cases, Amchem and Ortiz are not the only cases that talk about this. In the Seventh Circuit, for example, in the Second Circuit, in Re Literary Works, for example, you had three subclasses, A, B, and C. C had the least valuable. The C subclass comes in and says, hey, we're not being represented fairly. We want our own representation. And the district court said, no, it's okay, because A and B, they also have your claims. So it's all right. You're being protected. And the Second Circuit said, no, that's not okay. Because A and B, they might have some C claims, but they're not going to try and maximize recovery for C. They're going to try and get the most they can out of their A and B, their valuable claims, and let the C go by the wayside. And
now, before we get too far down the road, what should Olson be compensated for at all?
For his future, he does have future damages claims. Are you asking, does he really have a risk there?
Yeah.
I think he does, Your Honor, for several reasons. I think, first of all, plaintiffs, I don't think, challenge the fact that there are future damages here. Even in the complaint, in 62 different paragraphs, they said that all of these, the class, that there is an impending threat of future harm.
Does it have to be a real likelihood?
I don't think so. In this instance,
the Supreme Court has said real likelihood.
Are you referring to Spokio, Your Honor?
I'm not sure what I'm referring to, but.
Well, I think a good example of this is in the recent Seventh Circuit case in Lewert v. P.F. Chang's, which is 819 F3rd 963, and they looked at this kind of claim in an Article III standing and said, yes, there is a real increased risk of fraudulent charges and identity theft. That was an Article III context, which is slightly different. And as Amchem recognized, the Article III is antecedent to the 23A4 issues here. But it does indicate that there is some real harm here. I think another reason is there's federal law that protects this stuff for a long time. If you're a consumer of your financial information being compromised, you can go to the credit card bureau and place a 7-year extended fraud alert on your credit report. That's 15 U.S.C. 1681C-1. I mean, this reflects a legislative finding that this type of harm is long-lasting. There is real threat here. But I don't think there's any question. I don't think plaintiffs even allege that.
What about these actions that Target was to take or did take as a part of this deal, these precautions, these changes in their IT policy and sure. You know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely, the injunctive about. Relief.
Now, I know exactly. I think there's an allegation here that has value, that's going to benefit
everybody
in the class. Why isn't that enough?
Well, I think there's three reasons for that. The first reason is it's not enough because if my client opted out of the class, he'd still get all of those same protections that are being offered to everyone in the entire world that Target is doing. So that can't be consideration for release of his claims. If he can opt out and still get the same relief. Secondly, whether it is enough is really a 23E question on whether the settlement is fair and adequate and not whether he was adequately protected. We're not saying is injunctive relief enough for his type of claim. That's really, is the settlement fair and adequate under 23E? We're saying he wasn't represented here. He didn't have anyone at the table negotiating for him. And if he did, he'd likely get more than nothing, which is what he got here. But thirdly, under Dewey v. Volkswagen, this same issue was argued in front of the Third Circuit. And they said, well, it's okay that this residual group isn't getting any relief because everyone's getting injunctive relief. And the Third Circuit said, no, that's not okay. That's not enough. That doesn't cure this conflict between the two groups.
Well, jumping over to that issue of this injunctive relief, do I understand correctly that those actions, those remedial kinds of actions, they've already been taken?
Yes. In fact, Your Honor.
That they were already taken?
They were in place 9 months before the settlement. He was already appointed as an officer. And you can imagine the other types of relief that involved having a written policy and training relevant officers would have come with the appointment of an officer. And it was also in place before there was even a complaint.
I guess in a real way, those are actions that needed to be taken anyway to protect Target,
absolutely,
regardless of whether it had been sued or not.
Absolutely. And in the case of Galloway v. Kansas, the court recognized that if it's something that the court should be doing anyway under law, if a defendant is doing something because it's required under law or doing it already, that's not real relief.
Counsel, on your 23A4 argument, are you contending there's a single unrepresented subclass or are there multiple unrepresented subclasses? And the reason I ask is you talked about Mr. Olson having future damages.
Sure.
Others might have statutory damages.
Absolutely.
Depending on what state they're in. So how would you break down the settlement to represent all members of the class?
There are at least two because of the future and past. But there are statutory only. You'd have to look at every – I haven't done the state-by-state analysis. But, for example, in Alaska, you can only get your economic damages. So that legal remedy would be very similar to the present damages claims that are already being protected. I'm going to reserve for rebuttal.
You may. Mr. Asadis?
May it please the court. Vincent Asadis for Consumer Class Plaintiff Appellees. The standard of review for each issue raised by the objectors today is an abuse of discretion. And that's important because the district court certified a single settlement class relating to all victims of the same data breach who suffered the same type of injuries, all stemming from the same incident. And I think what's important, because we have to reset what we're talking about here, the benefits of the settlement were twofold, monetary. And if you look at the list of monetary relief that was provided to the entire class, you have time spent dealing with unauthorized charges, credit-related costs. If you went out and bought ID theft protection, or if you went out and bought credit report protection, if you had a higher interest rate, if you lost access to funds, and finally, there's a catch-all. Can you articulate any cost, anything, you tell us that you lost as a result of this breach? Now, in response to the questions that I asked at the final approval hearing, what does Mr. Olson want from a settlement of the litigation? Okay, they've now sort of latched onto this future claim. He used a card at Target. His own objection states that the card has now been canceled. He has a new card. Someone explain to me what the future harm there is. There is no future harm in a case where you have single present damages right now. The harm that could occur is this could happen again. So one of the things that was very important, and this is the second non-monetary relief from the settlement, which every member benefited from. And it's interesting to hear counsel say that these were already being implemented. If you look at the record, they've only cited to one person being appointed as a settlement class, or I'm sorry, as the chief security officer. They say nothing about the other information protection measures that Target took. And if you think it's easy to get a corporation to voluntarily agree to be subject to a court order to do certain things, then you haven't been dealing with corporations very often, because they don't readily agree to court orders that require them to do things. In fact, if you look at our complaint, we allege that Target, while they said they were abiding by the payment card industry data security standards, we allege they were not. We thought it was very important to have something written relief that required them to do this. But the only evidence in the record, beyond the information security officer, the other three major changes they made is our expert on data security, Dr. Poneman, who testified the importance of those changes.
But I thought they'd already made the changes.
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor, and you can look anywhere you want. The only citation is that Target appointed the chief information security officer. 2, 3, and 4, which we talk about, which the district court relied on, and the district court called, requires Target to improve data security practices in significant ways, is uncontroverted.
I want to go with you. I didn't want to interrupt the flow of your argument there, but I did. But I do want to ask you a simple little question, which is: do you think the court ever really considered Olson's objective? And under Petrovic, isn't that a mistake?
Absolutely, the court considered it.
And well, it says it won't revisit it.
Yeah, revisiting means it won't go back and find how they want it. Keep in mind what they were asking the court to do. They said, I'm not going to go back and change those findings because nothing you said has merit or changes my mind.
Well, no, he didn't. The district judge didn't say that. No, you're helping the district judge. The district judge, I think, says in total, Olson argues the settlement class can't be certified because class members who have not experienced a concrete have an irreconcilable conflict with class members. But the court certified a settlement class in the preliminary approval order and will not revisit that determination. That's everything he said. Doesn't he have to do more than that?
No, I actually don't think it has to be more than that. What they've asked for is that he do another order stating the same things he'd already done in this preliminary approval order.
When I go back to that, all I find is just a general statement that class counsel will fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class, have no interest in antagonistic or conflict with the class, and have retained experienced and competent counsel to prosecute this matter.
And those are the findings he made based on the uncontroverted allegations in the complaint. Each class member states their exact circumstances and how they were impacted by the breach. Three of them were deposed by Target. None of the facts related in the complaint about each one of those plaintiffs and their experiences is controverted by anybody. And the court looked at that, and the court had the access to that, and made the findings that there weren't any antagonistic interests.
But then Olson comes along and says, I'm different. A lot of other people are different. And the district court just says, no, back to that before I even knew you were different.
There is no difference, Your Honor, because if you read the complaint, there are many class representatives who fall into the category that Mr. Olson falls into, which is they did not suffer any false charge. They were impacted by the breach because their cards were taken, but they suffered no unauthorized charges or any of the nine enumerated losses that you could claim money for. And that's really the critical point, because at least 20 to 30 of the class representatives did not make a claim under the settlement because they were not eligible to make a claim. So to suggest that there isn't someone in his situation that was involved as a representative is belied by the facts of the case. And those allegations are in the complaint that the court had when it made the findings as to the adequacy of the class reps.
What about the 112 class representatives and that we don't know anything about 106 of them?
I don't understand that statement. There's paragraphs on each plaintiff in the complaint describing their exact situation.
Okay. Well, I'll figure out what it says.
And so let's get to this issue that really what we're talking about is only adequacy, not talking about the sufficiency. What they're saying is because this case is resolved where certain class members don't get any money, okay, therefore they weren't adequately represented. We believe this absolutely goes to the sufficiency of a settlement. When you look at the Marshall case, I think it's extremely instructive, and we think it's on all fours. And Marshall held, so long as you're giving an opportunity for the class members to make a claim for damages, that's all that's going to be required. So to somehow claim if somebody can't articulate a single cost, a single claim they would have for money, the fact that a settlement doesn't provide a direct financial benefit to them is not going to be impediment. And that's Petrovic as well. And to respond to some of the specific fundamental conflict points Ms. Holyoak made, the statutory damages. Well, Mr. Olson has no statutory damages in Texas. And he's never articulated what claim he would have in Texas that would survive his changing his credit card number. I asked that at the other hearing. I've asked it again today. I still haven't heard exactly what he's talking about. He did bring up Rhode Island.
Now, we had a district court finding on that?
On finding on?
On that very fact.
On that he suffered no injury? It's absolutely in the decision that says he's not articulated an injury.
Wait, where is that in the record? I think we just have the revisit. But tell me where it is.
Well, it's in his affidavit, Your Honor. He says he suffered none of the types of problems that were delineated in the claim form. And the last one being, just tell us.
I'm sorry, I thought you were referring to a finding by the way you phrased it.
No, but by his own admission, which the court relied on.
How do we know the court relied on it?
Well, because the court said it had taken a look at all the objections that have been filed and found them to be without merit. And I take the court at its word that it does careful work. With respect to the statutory damages question, they identified two states for which we don't have class representatives that have statutory damages. I think if you look at the Spokio decision that recently came out, this is the Supreme Court decision, that basically said if you can't articulate some harm or some concrete issue, you're not just going to get statutory damages just because you've pled a case and you have no, there's not going to be any chance that any damage ever befalls you. And I think what's interesting is that really what this comes down to is them arguing that we're getting $0 and trying to steer away from Marshall, which says $0 for class members who can't articulate a damage is perfectly appropriate, and trying to steer it into this land of adequacy as though that somehow avoids the decisions in this circuit. And I think that's an important distinction because the adequacy of representation means adequately protecting an interest. You've got to be able to specifically identify that interest that is being protected. And if you can't identify that interest, the court in the Eighth Circuit doesn't care if you don't get a direct payment. And that's controlling law in this circuit.
Isn't it about 99% or more of the class is getting $0 out of the settlement?
That's I don't know what the exact, there were 225,000
out of 90 some million in the class.
Roughly 97 million.
Right. And are you saying all of those people have no claim to statutory damage? All of the people who are getting shut out by this without any
people,
payment,
I'm sorry,
have no statutory damage claims?
I'm saying I would be highly suspect to somebody who can't articulate a single loss that they're going to be able to recover statutory damages after Spokio. And that decision came out last year, and I think answers that question. Anyway, in our judgment as counsel, when we're attempting to do a settlement on the benefit of a whole class, I think it's very reasonable to say, if you can articulate any kind of loss, we'll get you money. If you can't, like me, and there are many people probably in this room who fall into the category of had to use their card at Target, suffered no injury, but are going to find themselves back in Target, I'd like to have something more important than pushing a claim that almost has no chance of succeeding in some state that may never get certified on behalf of a class that would be extremely difficult to get certified. But of course, and I think the court understood this. One of their arguments in front of the district court was this case can't be certified at all. Okay, and as a litigation class, I think that's probably correct, not in the way we're doing it. But as a settlement class, I think it's entirely appropriate to certify under the conditions, and the district court found that as well. I have nothing else.
I've got a question. At one point below, the district court referred to, I think it's Mr. Olson, as a professional objector. I have two questions. Number one, what's in the record to support that statement? And number two, should that statement cause this court to be concerned or take some pause with respect to the objectivity of the district court?
No, to answer the last part of the question, no, I don't think it goes to the objectivity. The support for that, for the finding of that statement is found within the affidavit from the center itself. It is in the business of launching challenges to class actions. That's its business. That's what it goes around the country doing. That's the professional goal of that organization, is to do this. They don't, if they get something, and there are instances where they've had stuff sent back, they're not going to be here to help me figure out how to certify a class under each state's
law.
Where
in the record, if you can tell me?
I think it's the affidavit of Theodore Frank, and we cited in our brief as well.
Who's the affiant?
Ted Theodore Frank, but I believe we also have a reference to it in our brief. I can find the exact page.
Well, don't use your time to do that. We could find it with that name.
I have nothing more to add unless your honors have any additional.
You agree that even if there's a conflict, under our law, a district court can take reasonable steps to address it, right?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Solio?
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point that opposing counsel talked about was the abuse of discretion standard. In fact, in the Oop Honor case, this court said, quote, our court has applied heightened attention, close quote, to A4 adequacy issues under AmChem. And that is at 716 F3rd at 1063. So this court should also apply a heightened attention when it is looking at this rather than just an abuse of discretion.
Was that before Tyson? our Tyson and Supreme Court Tyson? Because it says abuse of discretion. But go ahead.
I don't remember, Your Honor.
I bet it is. Go ahead.
Opposing counsel talked about how Mr. Olson couldn't file a claim right now because he has future claims. But that's the whole point. It's the release that's releasing those future claims. He might not be able to file an action right now for those types of present damages. But what is happening under the settlement is he could never file them.
I think opposing counsel's point was Mr. Olson can't articulate any likely or even possible future claim because his only damage was his credit card was used and was then replaced with a new credit card. What could possibly happen in the future, or what did he articulate to the district court that could happen in the future to him?
Though I would argue that those are the same exact allegations in his complaint. In paragraph 12, for example, Plaintiff Kelly, that's in page 48 of the record, said that she had her credit and debit card stolen, and she has a threat, quote, impending threat of future additional harm from increased threat of identity theft. It's contained in their complaint in 62 paragraphs of their complaint, the same exact harm that they are saying that we do not have because they're releasing those types of claims. But she had the same thing, a credit card, debit card stolen, and then she had loss of access to funds. So because she had that, she gets some sort of compensation, but my client does not, and has to release his future damages for if he suffers those types of damages in the future. The Marshall case, completely inapplicable. E3 case had absolutely did not consider A4 at all. Opposing counsel talked about how the district judge said, I consider the objections and I rule against them. That is not enough from a district court. A district court must provide a reasoned analysis of all non-frivolous objections. He can't say, I'm not going to revisit my district court.
What's your best authority on that, counsel?
The Dennis case.
Is that this court's case?
That's in the Ninth Circuit.
Okay, how about this court?
In this court, the best would be Van Horn. And in Van Horn v. Turkey, the court there allowed, the district did not provide a reasoned analysis, and the court said, okay, it's all right this time because there's facts in the case that support this, and also because there's no allegation that there was a minority group of class members whose rights were sacrificed at the expense of the majority. That we are professional objectors is completely wrong. There's no evidence of that. In fact, the Ted Frank Declaration he's speaking to actually presents the opposite. In that, he says, yes, we are the Center for Class Action Fairness. We fight unfair class action abuse. But the professional objector is one who holds up a settlement. They file a notice of appeal, and then they get bought off. We weren't going to do that. And in fact, in Mr. Olson's declaration supporting his objection, he said, go ahead, court, enter an injunction that forbids me from really withdrawing my dismissal for some sort of payment. We won't do that. The evidence was opposite from the court's finding.
Thank counsel for their arguments. Case 15-3909 and the other 1, 2, 3, 4 of them listed with it are all submitted for decision.